Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. I am, of course, coming to you from the air-conditioned, feline-infested comfort of the coast-to-coast command bunker, about 20 levels below the surface of the desert. On this, the eve before the great solar eclipse of 2017, you know, I might have to risk taking a trip up to the surface, up to the top tomorrow to check it out. Plus, you know, we're running low on cat food down here. And we all know what cats will do if they have no other choice. Sending a shout out tonight to my brother David on his birthday. He is a loyal Coast listener, and I'm not exactly sure how old he is today, but since I, let me do the math here. He's 2 years younger than me. So if I subtract this, I think that makes him about 38. Though admittedly, math has never been my best subject. It's been almost a month since I was here last, and I'm jazzed to be back. We have two great guests, two engaging topics for you tonight. Robert Hastings is the world's foremost expert on UFO incidents involving nuclear weapons and nuclear bases. He's collected testimony and evidence from all over the world, has interviewed more than 150 military personnel who saw these things with their own eyes, experienced it for themselves. And he's not a guy you see at a lot of UFO conferences. You don't see him interviewed for these cheesy TV shows which cover the UFO subject. He's kind of selective about where he appears because credibility counts. His massive work, UFOs and Nukes, both in book and film form, are meticulously researched. And the message derived from his work, I think, is pretty sobering, to say the least. Robert Hastings joins us with new testimony and new cases in just a couple of minutes. Then in the second half tonight, hoodoo. It's not the same as voodoo, but it has its own dark and mysterious legacy. Its roots are on the African continent, but it's an all-American amalgam these days, and it does live on today. What is it? And more importantly, what it isn't? A new book by Tony Cale looks at the secret history of Memphis hoodoo. I sure learned a lot reading this book and think you'll also get a kick out of it. That's the second half tonight. You know, centuries ago, humans would see a massive celestial event such as this eclipse coming up and would assume the worst. You know, the gods must be angry. The world is ending. Or they blame their king or emperor or religious leaders. We've come a long way since then, I guess, though I would halfway expect someone to blame one or the other political party for what's going to happen Monday afternoon. You've heard the warnings, you know, don't look at the sun, not even for a quick glance. It's kind of the same as what your mom used to warn you about playing around with your BB gun. You'll put your eye out. This time you will burn your eye out, seriously. And your animals, too. You might want to keep your pets indoors when this is going on. Millions of people, of course, are driving to places where they will have a better vantage point for the eclipse, creating massive traffic jams along the route, especially in national parks. So if you're not already out there, might be better to watch from home. This will be the most photographed, most observed eclipse in human history. All sorts of cool experiments planned, the public pitching in to help scientists collect data and images. It'll be awesome. One last word, especially if you're watching it out here in the West. You know, it's a tinderbox out there. Whether you want to argue about climate change or not, I won't get into that, but it's been dry for a decade. We've had a terrible drought. This year was a little bit better, but it's still dry, and in much of the West, you got to be careful with fire, cigarettes, campfires, and for God's sakes, please don't uncork a bunch of fireworks during this eclipse and spoil the viewing for everyone else. It is literally a once-in-a-lifetime event, so, you know, make the most of it and cause no harm. With so many eyes to the skies, who knows what else people might see out there tomorrow? So if you end up spotting odd shapes, odd craft, UFOs, whatever, let us know about it. Sad news from here in Las Vegas today. Comedian and filmmaker Jerry Lewis died. He was 91 years old. Lewis raised, of course, a couple billion dollars through his MDA telethon. to battle muscular dystrophy. And that event, of course, was based for many years here. So I had the honor to meet him several times, talked to him over the years. He's was a brilliant, cantankerous, immensely influential performer. His final show, stage show, was just under a year ago on a stage here in Las Vegas. His death follows on the heels of another comedic legend, Dick Russell, who died yesterday. And he was a groundbreaking comic, very funny guy, but might just as well be remembered for his civil rights and social justice causes that he championed for many years. Webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of news items and oddities culled from all over the place. You can find them on the Coast to Coast website under the title Naps News. Among the stories tonight, an eclipse-related report about traffic jams in key viewing spots. A cool story about scientific news that's come out of Antarctica the past week or so. Volcanoes and fruitcake. A tasty combo there. I won't spoil what that means. You'll have to read it for yourselves. An interesting piece about people who vanish from the face of the earth while driving their cars. And in many cases, the cars are gone too. And a theory about time. Whether it exists at all or whether it's only a construct of the human mind. Thought-provoking stuff there. Plus, you think you have a terrible job? You think you've got it bad? You hate to go to work in the morning? Check out these jobs from back in Victorian times. Might make you feel better about work. I mean, these are the worst jobs imaginable, and I mean bad. With that, let's assume the position. Wait a second. Let me say, while you're looking at Naps News on the website, you could check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day if you subscribe for a year. You can access a vast inventory of previous programs, listen to them on just about any device as often as you want, anytime you want. You can also subscribe to George Norrie's TV program, Beyond Belief. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, put on a pot of Joe, crank up the AC, slip into those silky PJs and the bunny slippers, plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Robert Hastings, UFOs and Nukes. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings is the world's leading investigator of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites. He's been working on this particular angle since 1973, and in the interim, he's interviewed more than 150 U.S. military veterans regarding their involvement in such incidents during the Cold War era and beyond. You've seen him in a couple of news conferences. CNN live-streamed one of his events in 2010, but you don't see him in a lot of the typical UFO conferences or on typical UFO shows. We're going to ask him about that. It's great to have him back. We have links, by the way, on the Coast to Coast website to his films and books, and you want to check them out because they are meticulously researched. Robert, great to have you back.
Thank you, George. I appreciate it.
You know, whenever you come on the show, I get emails in advance of your appearances that ask me, why don't I see this guy on such and such a show? And why don't I hear various UFO poobahs and luminaries talking about his work? If he's so credible, you'd think that some of these other experts would incorporate some of his findings into what they do. You'd think he'd be out there at these conferences spreading the word. What's the deal?
I guess I need to be frank here. I've attempted as best as possible over the years to adhere to rules of evidence. I'm dealing with anecdotal evidence, not empirical evidence, which is to say I interview credible sources and use authenticated documents to make my points. And unfortunately, in ufology, in my opinion, there are a number of people who don't adhere to those basic principles, as would, say, a police detective or an investigative journalist. And in my view, that just degrades the overall quality of the data, and I really don't want to be associated with that crap. And so I'm getting to the point where I'm a grumpy old man and I speak my mind, but that's pretty much it.
You do get invited to these kinds of things. The TV shows call you up and want to interview you all the time, I'd imagine.
I've turned down 16 programs since I was on Larry King in 08, and those were Canadian, U.S., French, and English productions, and they all told me they were going to adhere to strict rules of evidence and use credible sources and vet the documents and so on, and when I saw 9 out of 10 of them once they were produced, they didn't. They clearly were using the wowie zowie fluff and bullshit formula, if I may say that, is prevalent in Hollywood's version of UFO research. And I just don't see the point, you know. There's an audience for that, sadly. If you were 12 or 16 years old, that's cool. If you're an adult and you swallow all of that without asking for the factual underpinning, then, you know, shame on you.
So it sounds like you'd be skeptical about stories, for example, of people traveling to Mars.
Yeah, let's go there. Yeah, Corey Good and his ilk, you know, I think that's a tragedy for anyone attempting to establish credibility for this subject. And, you know, the MUFON conference this past summer was just atrocious in my view. The persons that were asked to speak, and, you know, again, if you're into, any of your listeners are into spooky ghost stories told around a campfire, that's cool. But if you think that's credible data that you can, you know, hang your hat on and draw some sort of assessment about what UFOs are or not, then again, you're just fooling yourself. And there's a lot of people out there who are going to take advantage of you because you're too gullible.
The problems in the field and the problems in media that cover these topics is a primary reason why you made your own film, went your own way. So it's been a year since you've been on. Talk about the film a little bit, what's in it. And maybe for those who haven't heard you before on the program, give us the original premise and a general statement about the evidence and what you found.
Well, before I forget to mention, there is a wonderful person, Jared Tarbell, and his wife, Lori, who learned about my work some years ago and, to his great credit, provided me with the money to make this film. It's gotten rave reviews, by and large, except for very close-minded skeptics, and it's called UFOs and Nukes, The Secret Link Revealed. It is available at Vimeo.com, and I think you've got on your website tonight the fact that we have a word that you can put in that would allow somebody to purchase that for half price. The film itself is really the culmination of what I've been doing since the early 70s. I've taken a chronological historical overview of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites going back to essentially World War II, and it's continuing on to the present day. And we can get into some specific cases later, but cutting to the chase, there are now hundreds and hundreds of credible ex-military sources who have said that UFOs have been monitoring our nuclear laboratories, our test sites in Nevada and the Pacific. They've appeared above our nuclear missile sites at virtually every base in America that has nuclear missiles. And it's clearly a question of, for whatever reason, and I don't pretend to know myself, whoever are flying these craft, they've had a long-standing, widespread, and ongoing interest in America's nuclear weapons. You yourself, of course, contribute to this narrative in a very significant way by smuggling, if I can use that word, classified documents out of the former Soviet Union when you were interviewing ex-Soviet military personnel in the 90s. And thanks to your work, we now know that the same incidents that were occurring here in the U.S., of UFOs hovering over our nuclear missiles and then the missiles going haywire, were indeed occurring in the Soviet Union. So this is clearly a phenomenon whereby whoever are flying these craft are not playing favorites. They apparently are quite concerned, or, you know, who knows why, but they clearly have made it a point of monitoring and even tampering with nuclear weapons around the world. I think that's self-evidently, you know, significant and worthy of everyone's attention. I was gratified when CNN live-streamed my press conference. It was co-sponsored with Bob Salas, who is a former Air Force captain, missile launch officer, who had his missiles, all 10 missiles, shut down by a UFO at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967. We were both amazed, frankly, that we got live coverage from CNN and worldwide coverage for this subject. However, a week later, it was as if these military witnesses had never said anything and we had never held the event, because it was back to business as usual with the mainstream media either ignoring or sometimes even ridiculing the subject. So we've made the effort. Hopefully we've made a small dent in skepticism around the world. Hopefully we've contributed a little bit of information that's worthy of public attention in the larger scheme of things. For better or worse, that's pretty much what I've done with my life for the last 40 years.
You have the, and we'll get into some specifics about incidents where these visitors, these intruders, demonstrate amazing technological capabilities. It's almost like they want to be seen. I mean, you have to guess that if they didn't want to be seen, they could observe in some way that wouldn't be so obvious.
I think that's exactly right. I've called it display behavior. That's a term that anthropologists use. And animal behaviorists talking about the animal display behavior for one reason or another. I think if you've got the sophistication to create a craft that can fly between stars, you don't need to have flashing lights on it, you know. And yet, when they appear above cities or small towns or missile sites, they seem to have a lot of wowie zowie flashy light displays. I think that's for our benefit to say, hey, we're real, we're here, look what we're about to do to your missiles. Or if they're over, you know, a large metropolitan area and they engage in zigzag behavior, you know, they fly zigzag, zigzag. I doubt that they actually needed to do that to cover from point A to point B. And the zigzag, I think, is just more for our benefit, so we'll pay attention and look. And interestingly, you mentioned the eclipse tomorrow. There's a number of cases over the years, that the most prevalent one being the most well-known one, total eclipse in Mexico City in 1991. Millions of people saw at least two saucer-shaped craft in the skies above Mexico City during the eclipse. And again, in my view, that's was intended for our benefit. So they knew millions of people would be looking upward. I forget, Mexico City's got like 20 million people, I believe. So they go out of their way to appear in the skies above events. I'm aware of certain rock festivals, one in Maine, another one in New Zealand, that have come to my attention, where there were aerial events like fireworks, and then in the midst of the fireworks at these rock concerts, there were saucers hovering above the festivals. Again, almost as if they knew that large numbers of people would be looking up, and they would use it as an opportunity to sort of show off.
Well, that's what I was wondering about the eclipse. There'll be tens of millions of people looking up tomorrow, I wonder.
I'll bet you there will be stories on Tuesday from somewhere in the world. This is primarily in the United States. Hopefully some people will look not only at the eclipse, but around the sky while they're looking up, and might indeed see something.
You know, we'll get into specifics about whether we're cases where they go further than just observing and making themselves seen, because there are some pretty dramatic encounters that you detail in your book and your film. But it always makes you wonder what ultimately they want to do. They want to be seen, but the message is not always real specific.
I think, and I say this in my book, and I'll plug my book now. The second edition is up at Amazon, and I believe you have a link at your website. But I think there are good anecdotal data to suggest that we have multiple races operating here. The morphologies described are so diverse. You've got 7-foot beings being described. You have 3-foot beings. You have human-looking beings, insectoid-looking beings. And these accounts come from credible people, including hundreds and hundreds of law enforcement personnel around the world over the past 7 decades. If indeed there are multiple races of ETs operating here, which I think is what's going on, to my mind, that would imply probably a diversity of agendas. One would not think that they all have the same game plan. And so it's difficult to talk about them and what their plan is, because we're probably talking about several kinds of them and perhaps several agendas. I have said to my lecture audiences for 35 years, don't infer that because a saucer hovers above a missile and shuts it down, they're not necessarily saying you humans are playing with fire, although I think that's part of the equation. In other words, it's not strictly a warning for us to get our act together in terms of nuclear weapons. But if they have long-standing presence here on Earth and bases, perhaps, and projects of one kind or another, the abduction cases are very fascinating to me. I think there's suggestion of something long-standing and ongoing there, too, involving human interaction with humans. If all of that is in place and not just a fantasy, then you could see quite easily how they would have selfish concerns as well. They wouldn't want us to screw up the planet with nuclear weapons.
Right. Robert, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. We're going to go to a break. Robert Hastings, UFOs and Nukes, my guest. Elvis, One Night with You. 40 years ago this month, Elvis left the building for good, and this might be my favorite song of his. We'll be right back. Some dark imagery there, some really crisp lyrics from the album The Rising, Bruce Springsteen, further on up the road. I want to correct an egregious error I made during the opening segment. I had mentioned about the death of comedian Jerry Lewis, and then this is what I get for ad-libbing another story, is that I also reported, just kind of off the top of my head, the death of comic Dick Gregory. I didn't say Dick Gregory, though. I said Dick Russell. I think Dick Russell is a JFK researcher, and he's been on my mind. I did a story about a new JFK film a week ago, so that's probably the source of the error. But it's Dick Gregory, the comedic legend who died over the weekend, and I really regret the error. But we correct our errors here. We're talking with Robert Hastings about UFOs and nukes. He's come up, since the last time he was here a year ago, he's come up with some new witnesses, new information about very dramatic encounters. We're going to get into those in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings, you must get calls out of the blue, emails all the time from former servicemen who have been holding these secrets for a long time, want to tell somebody, and that finally the dam bursts and out it comes. What is the process that you start as a way to verify their information before you ever go public with it?
Well, I do indeed get hundreds and hundreds of emails every year from veterans who have one story or another to tell. It's important to vet them, of course, so as a prerequisite, I need to have their DD-214 before I publish what they've told me. That's basically a comprehensive service record that says what they did in the service, usually the Air Force, and where they were stationed and in what positions they held while they were at those bases. And so at least that establishes that they're not Joe Blow from, you know, Tasmania pretending to be a U.S. Air Force veteran. So that of course is essential. I've heard enough stories over 40 years now. There's common themes that strike me as true, ring true. There's subtle little details that even I don't publish because they're kind of arcane, but they come up again and again in these narratives, which again is sort of a tip off that these guys were on the inside and they were handled in a certain way after the incident and so on. But yes, and it's an ongoing thing. Most of the cases that are brought to my attention are decades old, but that doesn't make them any less important. And I understand why the veterans have been reticent to go public with their stories.
Do you get people who call you up with a story that is specifically designed to affect your credibility? That maybe it's even an insider who knows what the interior of one of these nuclear bunkers is like, and they tell you something as a way to discredit you and pull the rug out from under you?
Well, I think that's entirely possible. I can't honestly point to more than two occasions where literally two occasions where persons told me a story. I got their DD-214, so I know they were at this base in this squadron doing the job they said. But each time I interviewed them for additional detail, the story changed or got better and better, which is definitely a tip off that something's not right. At the very least, the person is, you know, exaggerating and really should not have their testimony published. No one, to my knowledge, has just outright tried to pull a fast one on me. I believe that anything I've published, I've been very careful to check out every way that I'm capable of checking out.
Well, let's talk about some new stuff. Not new cases, but newly investigated cases. The one is that you mentioned to me in an email, this former U.S. Air Force nuclear missile guard, Mario Woods. Talk about how that came to you, what the process was and what the story is.
He actually saw my film and contacted me, and I think potentially this is going to be one of the most important incidents that I've ever investigated. Not only, and I'll sort of capsulize it here, not only was he responding to a UFO hovering over a missile site along with his security alert team partner, but based on the available evidence at this point, it seems as if there's a high likelihood that he and his partner were actually abducted by whoever was aboard this craft. So unlike the dozens and dozens of cases like this I've investigated since the 70s, this one may have a wrinkle to it that ultimately ties in UFO activity with missile site with an actual alien abduction. At least that's the tentative conclusion I'm drawing. So to go back and to provide some detail, Mario Woods was a missile security policeman. He earlier asked me today not to call him a guard. That apparently is inappropriate terminology. In any case, he was stationed at Ellsworth Air Force Base, South Dakota. In November of 77, he was out at what was called the November Flight Launch Control Facility. Flights of missiles are groups of 10 Minuteman missiles controlled by a central launch control capsule, which is underground. It's manned by two Air Force launch officers. Above that underground capsule, where they actually launch 10 missiles in groups of 10 called flights, is this facility where the security personnel stay. There's a cook there, a site manager, and so on. So Mario Woods, who was a senior airman in 77, was at this November flight facility one night, he thinks roughly 2 weeks before Thanksgiving of 77. He walked outside for a smoke, saw this bright object in the sky that he was pretty sure was not a star or planet, thought it might be a B-52 or a helicopter, but still didn't look like that either. So on a whim, he decided he would flash the facility lights at it. And when I asked him why he would do that, he said his father was a merchant seaman and he used to sail with him. And when ships are communicating at sea, they have these big blinker lights that they communicate with each other via Morse code. So that was apparently what was going through his head when he decided to flash these very bright security lights at this facility at this object. So he goes back in, tells the chief security person, the flight security controller, what he had in mind. The guy kind of laughed at him, but said, okay, go ahead. So he flashed the light 6 or 8 times, and long story short, he didn't see much of a response from the object. It didn't flash back, but ultimately, over the course of about an hour, it seemed to move much closer to the facility. So he goes back inside. He's getting ribbed by some of the other guys in there, you know, because he's flashing the lights at a UFO or whatever. And then at 1:30 a.m., he estimates, suddenly they get alarms on one of the missiles called November 5. So he and his partner, who I will not identify here yet because I don't have his permission to go public with his name, Mario Woods and his partner go to this November 5 facility in their security vehicle. As they're getting closer, they see clearly that this strange light is now directly above the missile site that the alarms have gone off at. And as they get close up to it, he said, and Mario has emphasized this a number of times to me on the phone, he said this object was spherical, it was swirling reddish-orange in color, it was silent, and he said the width of it, he would estimate, was about as wide as a Walmart building. It was huge. And so he and his partner are sitting there. They didn't dare go on the site. They're a couple hundred yards back looking at it, wondering what to do next. And all of a sudden, he can't breathe. He said it's like all the air was sucked out of the crew cab. And he looks over and his partner is also suffocating, just gasping for air. So again, thinking, you know, like he would have as when he was with his father at sea, he rolls down the window, sits up on the windowsill of the truck, and flashes his big military flashlight at the object. Again, his thinking was maybe, you know, this suffocating will end if I somehow communicate to them. Seconds later, he kind of falls back into his seat. The next thing he knows, he's in a daze. He was almost like passing out. He suddenly hears voices in his head saying, "Do not fear." And he says over and over, he said there are multiple voices in his head saying, "Do not fear." And he looks to the right of the truck and sees something like shadows moving toward the truck. He said he thinks that they were five or six small little beings, entities on two legs walking toward the vehicle. And behind those small figures was a taller figure that he somehow in his mind knew or sensed was in control. The next thing he knows, he hears, he looks over his partner, and his partner was gasping for air. But after he sat back in the truck and was sitting there in a kind of a daze, he didn't look at his partner again. He didn't know what was going on with him. Seconds later, what seemed like seconds to him, he hears the radio crackling. It's the flight security controller saying, what's your status? And he thinks only a second or two has gone by, and he said, "We're about to strike the site. We're moving the truck into position. We're going to pull out our weapons and address this object hovering over the site." And then the voice on the other end of the radio, the supervisor, comes back and says, "Where are you?" And Mario said that was a very strange question. You know, they had sent him out to November 5. They were near the site, as far as he knew. But then he said he couldn't see the site's security lights. So he told the flight security controller, "I don't know where we are. Let me look." He steps outside of the truck, and he's standing next to this huge concrete wall, which turns out to be a dam, a reservoir, 5 miles east of the missile site. And, you know, he's confused. He has no idea what's going on. Meanwhile, they've triangulated the radio signal, and in short order, four or five other security teams come up on them and find them and locate them and drive them back to the site. Mario said he was trying to ask questions of the other security police and basically was told, "We can't talk to you about this situation." And again, he's still thinking, you know, this is just a few seconds after they saw the UFO over the missile site. When they're debriefed back at November 1, the launch control facility, it turns out that they've been missing for 4 hours. His security alert team partner is still so out of it that he can't tell anyone who's talking to him, you know, where he was, what happened. He has no idea. And moving ahead a couple of weeks, Mario said that this partner, security alert team partner, came over and visited him at home out of the blue. And, you know, they were going, "What in the hell is that? You know, what's going on here?" And he, too, then admitted to Mario that after they were having this suffocating fit and they couldn't breathe, he, too, in his head heard a voice saying, "Do not fear." Many voices, Mario says. And what freaked Mario out at that point was not only did he hear the voices, but apparently his partner was laying flat somewhere. He wasn't in the truck anymore. And so the inference was that he was removed from the vehicle before these voices were appearing in his head. And even more to Mario's horror, his partner said, "When I was laying on this whatever slab table, I looked on the floor and I saw your mittens. I saw Mario's military gloves," which implied that Mario was right there with him out of the vehicle. So again, the tentative inference is that this indeed was an abduction by those aboard the UFO of these two men. And they were somehow transported after this interaction 5 miles east to this location next to this dam. And Jared Tarbell, again, who funded my film, has graciously agreed to fund, underwrite hypnosis sessions for Mario. We're going to attempt to elicit memories, suppressed memories, forgotten memories. That technique, of course, is controversial, but I know for a fact that despite what skeptics say, that there's really no good data that comes out of regression hypnosis, there are hundreds of police departments who use it as a viable investigative technique and think that the technique is quite valid. So we are going to make an effort to try to learn additional details from this experience. If it is what it seems to be, I wouldn't say that it's unique. It may have happened at other bases involving these missile security personnel, but it's the first case in 40 years that I've come close to where it does seem to involve not only a UFO hovering over a missile site, but also an abduction of the security personnel by whoever were piloting the craft.
Well, that is mind-blowing on multiple levels. The first one that occurs to me is this security police officer is saying, hey, I'm seeing this thing outside, tells his other security chief about it, goes inside, and nobody pays any attention to it. That's amazing to me. It's also amazing to me that this thing, whatever it is, doesn't show up on some kind of sensor at such a sensitive installation.
Well, apparently, as I understand it from his testimony, verbal and written testimony, the object was some distance away. Again, he thought it might have been lights on a B-52 or a helicopter. So it wasn't really right on top of the launch control facility. I'm sure there are security sensors on the perimeter of that facility as well, but the primary sensors, the alarms, are out on the missile sites, which are miles away from that central launch control facility. And clearly, at some point, according to this narrative, this light that was in the sky positioned itself at low. He said it was only 10 to 15 feet off the ground, and yet it was the size of a Walmart Mart building. I mean, you can imagine coming up on it in a vehicle, even though you were armed with an M16, seeing something like that, it would scare you to death. And I give great credit to Mario Woods for going public and allowing me to use his name. He's adamant that this happened, and he said, I don't care what people think about this story. It happened to me. I was there. It's, you know, it's bothered me all of my life. He says he still has nightmares about these little figures approaching the vehicle. So in addition to the hypnosis sessions that we have planned in the near future, he did give me the names of four other individuals who were in the site that night. And so we're just now making efforts to try to locate those individuals to see if, assuming they're still alive, if they're willing to go on the record about any part of this story that's now come forward.
And the partner, you're not mentioning the name, but have you spoken to the partner? Or can you say
that? We're attempting to find him, but until I get any of these guys' names, sure. You know, and talk to them and get their permission to use their names publicly, that's all I'm going to say about those guys.
So two guys who are security officers at such a sensitive and important installation are gone for 4 hours. That's a pretty serious deal. That's serious under any circumstances.
Quite serious. And the fact that, you know, one of the mysteries we have here is just roughly using Google Earth, I roughly determined that this reservoir is about 5 miles east or east northeast of the launch facility, November 5. Somehow that truck and those two men had to be transported to that. You know, the question is, did the UFO actually lift the truck with the men in it and deposit it over at this other location? Or after this encounter, you know, where they apparently were laid out on some sort of table and interacted with, were they put back in the truck and then perhaps in a panic as they're coming out of, you know, this dazed experience, did they actually drive themselves there? And so that's an unanswered question at this point. But they clearly didn't stay on site, and that's why the other teams had difficulty finding them for some period of time.
Did Mario say whether he faced any discipline? Or did the other people seem to know that something had happened that wasn't his fault?
Not per se, nothing like that. What they were rigorously interrogated. The military term is debriefed. And the next day, he apparently was driven onto the base back to Ellsworth and was put in the office with the wing commander, the missile wing commander, and by himself, and was further interrogated. This element I've heard again and again with the wing commander was a man in civilian clothes. And I know from past investigations, it's a virtual certainty that was an agent from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which has decade after decade at every base in the U.S. and in England, the famous Rendlesham Forest case. There's always OSI guys involved with the debriefing and interrogation. They're not identified. They rarely ask questions. They usually just listen. But there's always one of those mysterious guys in civilian clothes with the officer who's doing the debriefing.
We're talking with Robert Hastings about some chilling incidents involving UFOs and nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons facilities. We'll return to this story, as well as explore a couple of other new cases that he's dug up that are included in the second edition of his book, UFOs and Nukes, and we'll be right back with more of that. Neil Young wrote this song back when he was with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. It's called Helpless. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM.